Good morning. May it please the court. Time permitting, I intend to address two issues today, two main issues. First, whether there's extraterritorial jurisdiction over the sole count in the superseding indictment under 18 U.S.C. section 1956F. And secondly, whether the admission of appellant's confession and incriminating evidence seized by FBI agents from his cell phone violated the Fourth Amendment. And I will address those both with respect to the plain error version of the claim and the ineffective assistance of counsel version of the claim. I'll begin with the extraterritorial jurisdiction issue. I want to address three sub-issues. First, the applicable standard of review. Second, the fact that Section 1956F is a jurisdiction-limiting statute. And third, application of the lingering doubt standard, which is a component of the presumption against extraterritorial application of a statute. Regarding the standard of review, this court should engage in de novo review and not plain error review of the statutory interpretation issue for three separate reasons. First, the district court ruled on this issue after briefing and an oral argument, wrote a written published opinion on it. Second, analogous to the issue of whether civil diversity jurisdiction exists under 28 U.S.C. section 1332, the issue of whether extraterritorial jurisdiction exists under section 1956F unquestionably is an issue of subject matter jurisdiction. The Supreme Court's decision in Arbaugh in 2006 explicitly says, if a statute uses the word jurisdiction, it is referring to subject matter jurisdiction. And they drew the analogy to 1332. Well, 1956F is very analogous to 1332, and therefore it can be raised at any point. I did raise it in a lower court, but I'm also permitted to raise it for the first time on appeal, and it should receive de novo review. This is not a merits issue. This is a subject matter jurisdiction issue. And then finally, even assuming for the sake of argument that plain error review does apply, the Supreme Court in Fowler versus United States made it clear that in addressing a threshold statutory interpretation issue that relates to, assuming this is a sufficiency of the evidence as opposed to a jurisdictional question, you should engage in de novo review of that threshold statutory interpretation issue as the court did in Fowler. Finally, even if this court were to apply a full-fledged plain error review standard, the error is plain based on the Supreme Court's well-established rules concerning extraterritorial jurisdiction of a jurisdiction-limiting statute. Section 1956F is such a statute. It explicitly limits. It does not create jurisdiction. The government and the district court and a couple of other courts around the country that have interpreted this, and there have not been many cases, they've all just assumed this statute gives jurisdiction. It does not. It limits jurisdiction. The Supreme Court in Microsoft said that the presumption against extraterritoriality, including the all-important lingering doubt standard, remains instructive in determining the extent of the statute. So we're talking about applying the lingering doubt standard to a jurisdiction-limiting statute. If there's any doubt after reviewing the text and the legislative history of that statute, there is no extraterritorial jurisdiction. We're not dealing with an ordinary criminal statute where the government's trying to apply it in an extraterritorial manner. That's what most of these cases involve. This is different. This is a jurisdictional limiting statute, and that's the key that needs
to be. Were there victims in the United States?
Yes, Your Honor.
And they were part of this offense is a single count of a money laundering conspiracy. Part of it, at least, maybe the most important part, occurred within the confines of the United States, correct?
That's true if it were a substantive offense. Under Whitfield.
Well, it's a conspiracy. One count. Part of it occurred in the United States. Part of it occurred overseas.
If this was
to me, what you're arguing for is that they can't use the evidence of what occurred overseas. They can only use what happened in the United States. These things cross international borders, my friend.
Your question, Your Honor, is a good one.
I'm not so sure that I'm. This is not just a red herring. What you're talking about.
Well, here's the problem for the government. Here's the problem for the
government. And the government says that in their brief, and Judge Grimm sort of says it too, in his opinion. He wrote a big, long opinion on this thing.
He actually didn't discuss this issue very much. He discussed another issue.
The government talks hard from, if government, to prove in a conspiracy, they're not confined to the evidence of what happened with respect to it in this country. They can prove it occurred in another, in 100 more countries than want to, or if they're able to, and if it did occur.
What Your Honor is saying would be true if they had charged, if the government had charged.
I'm saying it isn't true. I don't think I'm off base much on this.
Well, here's the problem. Here's the problem.
I've been in the county's criminal business for a long time.
So again, turning to the language of 1956F, which the court has to look at the text as well as the legislative history, it says, in the case of a non-United States citizen, and it also refers to the statute only applies to the conduct prohibited by this subsection. That has to mean what you're charged and convicted of. It can't mean other things. It's basic that you have to have, and it says in the case of, which the Supreme Court says that's a prosecution or a cause of action. So the only thing that matters here is the conspiracy charge. And Whitfield said very clearly in 2005 that the only elements of money laundering conspiracy are the formation of an agreement. There is no overt act requirement. There's no transaction requirement. It's
simple. No overt act requirement, but you can lose a lot of evidence in proving the conspiracy, my friend, of what went on.
You certainly can offer that at trial. I'm not saying the government couldn't offer that in a conspiracy.
You have to prove the crime. The government can offer the whatever evidence they have, wherever
they
it comes
can.
From.
But just like the categorical
wherever.
Just like the categorical approach, the court is limited to the elements of the offense. Whitfield says the elements are a formation of a criminal conspiracy. That's it. No conduct, no actions, nothing along those lines can be considered as an element. Now, proving it's a different story, of course. People prove conspiracies by proving the substantive offenses all the time. But the language of the statute says there is extraterritorial jurisdiction over the conduct prohibited by this subsection. That has to mean you are limited to looking at what's charged in the indictment. They did not charge him with a substantive offense under 1956A. They solely charged him with a conspiracy offense. The statute that we're talking about here was written in 1986.
Have you given up this claim on the superseding indictment?
No, I'm not giving it up. I'm just putting I'm putting my powder in what I consider my best claim.
You think these other two issues are your strongest?
No, I'm going to address the Fourth Amendment. I have time.
You're going to rely on the brief on the statute of limitations.
I'm going to rely on the brief on the statute of limitations. I believe it's adequate.
All right.
So if I could go back to the extraterritorial jurisdiction issue. So you've got to look at each part of 1956F. So over the conduct prohibited by this subsection clearly means what you're charged with. It cannot mean what evidence was offered. This is like the categorical approach. Secondly, in the case of a non-United States citizen, the conduct occurs in part in the United States. In the case of means in the prosecution of. That's the only way to interpret in the case of. Even if it's ambiguous, this is also very important. Under the lingering doubt standard, this is not the rule of lenity. I don't have to show a grievous ambiguity. I only have to show any doubt. And if there's any doubt, either in the language, the text of the statute, or in the legislative history, we win. That's the strength of the lingering doubt standard. So there are two parts I really want to talk about here now. One is the term, the conduct occurs in part in the United States. We spent a lot of ink in our briefs fighting about what that means. At the very least, it is ambiguous based upon Whitfield. This is very important.
That's clear as the bell. Conduct occurs in part in the United States.
The American citizen co-conspirator conduct.
Plaintiff's committee.
So there is no overt act requirement. Therefore, what a co-conspirator does or doesn't do in the United States is irrelevant to the elements of the offense. the sole elements of the offense for this statute, unlike a traditional 371 conspiracy, is the defendant agreed to commit a crime. There's no question that was solely done in Nigeria. Appellant did not enter the United States for, I think it was 2 years after the conspiracy ended. He came on an F-1 student visa, and that's when they arrested him.
A person agree with themselves, they got to agree with somebody else.
Correct.
Some others.
Correct.
You don't one person conspiracy, my friend.
But a person, in the case of a non-United States citizen means you're looking at the non-United States citizen's conduct. You're not looking at a co-conspirator's conduct. At the very least, there is...
What a co-conspirator does, under settled principles of conspiracy law, what one does, they all do.
That's
what
true.
One does, they all do. The agency relationship governs that. What one conspirator does is attributed to everyone else who was a conspirator at the time the act occurred, wherever it occurred.
That is true in a traditional 371 conspiracy. It's not true.
That's true in conspiracy law in the federal courts, as far as I'm concerned.
It is true for purposes of looking at traditional
conspiracy. I've tried dozens of these conspiracy cases.
You've got to filter that. Your Honor, you have to filter that through Section 1956F. It is a jurisdiction-limiting statute. If there's any doubt that Congress was at all unclear about what this means, and there's clearly doubt for this reason, that statute was written in 1986 before the conspiracy statute provision was added to the money laundering statute. It was never amended thereafter. It was written for a substantive offense. It was not written for a conspiracy offense. There's another reason. 1956F12, it requires also for extraterritorial jurisdiction, it requires there to be a transaction in at least in excess of $10,000. There is nothing in the conspiracy statute requiring a transaction. There's nothing. You can just agree to do a money laundering offense and you've violated the law. Again, the government's, what they're trying to do is they're trying to put a square peg of a substantive extraterritorial offense statute, which was written in 1986 when there was only a substantive offense in 1956A. And they're trying to put the conspiracy into that square peg into a round hole. It doesn't fit. Transaction is not an element of conspiracy. Nor is conduct. Even if what Your Honor is saying were to be filtered correctly through 1956F regarding F1, it doesn't work with F2. Again, this statute puts extra things on the government to prove to be able to exercise jurisdiction. So traditional conspiracy principles and Pinkerton and all of that, they don't apply to 1956F based on its express language. And then you also have to look at the legislative history. So if you look at the Senate report, which is the leading thing, it says that the statute's intended to limit jurisdiction. It is not the committee's intention to impose a duty on foreign citizens operating wholly outside of the United States to become aware of U.S. laws. Mr. Ojukwu was entirely outside of the United States during this time. It's not talking about co-defendants in the United States or co-conspirators. It's talking about defendants where the government's trying to exercise extraterritorial jurisdiction. They have to do something. And in a conspiracy under 1956H, you don't have to do anything other than agree. You cannot, therefore, exercise extraterritorial jurisdiction over somebody in that situation. They could have charged him with aiding and abetting a substantive count. They did not. They only charged him with conspiracy. And they're stuck. They're stuck because there's ambiguity at the very least in 1956F. Well, briefly, the Fourth Amendment claim. The law and the facts are clear. It was not raised in the court below. I'm arguing it as plain error. I'm alternatively arguing it as an ineffective assistance of counsel claim. Peyton versus New York, New York versus Harris, and Jardines versus Florida all stand for the proposition that what happened in this case was an unlawful entry into a home without valid consent or alternatively staying beyond the limited scope of consent given. There was getting the confession and getting the cell phone contacts after the Iron Curtain, so to speak, had fallen on the Fourth Amendment. It's all tainted fruit. New York versus Harris makes it very clear the remedy is suppression. The government's attenuation arguments don't work. The remedy is suppression. The law was clear. The facts were clear. Therefore, it's both reversible as plain error. And alternatively, this is one of those rare cases where it conclusively is shown on the record deficiency, and I discussed the prejudice in my brief. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Noon. Mr. Pelletieri.
Thank you, Your Honor. And may it please the court, John Pelletieri on behalf of the United States. The prosecution of Mr. Ojigokun for money laundering conspiracy was proper under either step one or step two of the framework for evaluating extraterritoriality that the Supreme Court has set forth in a number of recent cases. Step one asks whether there has been whether the presumption against extraterritoriality has been rebutted. So the presumption is that Congress intends to only legislate for conduct that occurs within the territorial jurisdiction of the United States. But then, so that's the presumption, and then the court looks, using all the tools of statutory interpretation, to determine whether there's a clear indication that that presumption is rebutted and that the statute does apply to extraterritorial conduct. Here, there is an express extraterritoriality provision in 1956F, and it provides, as relevant here, that there is extraterritorial jurisdiction over the conduct prohibited by this section if, in the case of a non-United States citizen, the conduct occurs in part in the United States. So there are two questions. Number one, what is the conduct prohibited by this section? And number two, did this conduct occur in part in the United States? Because it's undisputed that Mr. Ojigokun is a Nigerian citizen. So the conduct here is a money laundering conspiracy prescribed by 1956H. Now, a conspiracy, the Supreme Court has made clear that the actus reus of a conspiracy, even one that does not require proof of an overt act, is the criminal agreement. That is the actus reus, it's conduct. That is it's a partnership in crime, a criminal venture. And that criminal venture.
So let's get good. I like the way you start in terms of getting some staging this. You're saying the mere agreement is conduct?
Yes, Your Honor.
How could that be? You mean, so all you're just having a conversation with someone, that's conduct?
It is a criminal conspiracy. It's an agreement toward
But here's the thing, is that you're saying that talking to someone and they're agreeing with what you said is conduct?
Absolutely, Your Honor. And I'll point you to the Shabani case in the Supreme Court, 513 U.S. 10 at 16 says, the prohibition against criminal conspiracy does not punish mere thought. The criminal agreement itself is the actus reus and has been so viewed since Regina v. Bass, which is a 1705 British case. And this is fully consistent with the law of venue. The law of venue looks...
Well, if that's the case, then there's no limitation to this extraterritorial... That means that no one has to be in the United States other than one person on the phone and you spoke to them and you're a non-citizen and you agreed, you're saying that's enough.
If you enter into a criminal conspiracy, if some person is in Nigeria and another person is in the United States, that criminal agreement has occurred in both Nigeria and the United States, both places. It is a criminal partnership in crime among individuals in both locations. And that is fully consistent, Your Honor, with the law of venue. I mean, the law of venue asks, you know, it asks the Supreme, the Constitution says that crimes have to be prosecuted where they have been committed. And then to determine where the crime has been committed, the Supreme Court said in Rodriguez-Moreno that a court must initially identify the conduct constituting the offense and then discern the location of the commission of the criminal acts. And this court said in Smith that venue is proper only in a district in which an essential conduct element of the offense took place. And
right, you just said conduct element, but there is no conduct element to conspiracy for money laundering.
But Your Honor, this court and every court has concluded that venue for conspiracy is proper in any jurisdiction where one of the co-conspirators is present at the formation of the agreement, that because that is the where the conduct occurs, in any jurisdiction where that the defendants are present, where the co-conspirators are present.
Yeah, but normally, I mean, in terms of most conspiracies require some act in furtherance. Everyone in the conspiracy.
But Your Honor, this court is.
Go ahead.
This court has said that a conspiracy offense takes place, and this is in Balance, and you said it in Levy Auto Parts, we cited in our brief, that wherever the agreement was made, and that's here in Nigeria and the United States, or wherever any overt act in furtherance of the conspiracy transpires. So there's two ways of evaluating the location of a conspiracy. Number one, the location of the conspirators at the time of the formation of the agreement, and the conduct for the conspiracy takes place in every single one of those jurisdictions at the time of the formation of the partnership in crime. And number two, wherever any overt act in furtherance of the conspiracy takes place. And this court has applied, and the Supreme Court has applied that in Whitfield itself, in a case where a conspiracy statute does not require as an element proof of an overt act. Nonetheless, even though it's not an element, overt act is not an element, that conspiracy, the conduct occurs in any place where overt acts and furtherance of the conspiracy take place. And that is fully consistent with the.
Yeah, but you're arguing in circles now. You're saying venue is appropriate wherever the act occurs. That's true. But you got to get back to the front end. No act or conduct is required for a conspiracy for money laundering. Right?
Your Honor. The actus reus, an actus reus is an act. That is the definition of an actus reus.
No, the actus reus in a sense is the bad thing.
No, it's the act and not the mental state. So an act, and the Supreme Court has said, the actus reus of a criminal conspiracy is the criminal agreement. Two people come together, and we cited also.
That's generally so, but has it ever been said that in the sense that that means that money laundering is a little different. It's kind of a different type of conspiracy.
No, Your Honor, it's not. It's the same. And in Whitfield, I think the court said, look, this is effectively by not the language of the statute effectively encompassed common law conspiracy. So that did not require an overt act. And this is longstanding law that a conspiracy involves conduct that is the agreement, at a minimum, the agreement. And in addition, overt acts and furtherance of the agreement, but at a minimum, the agreement. And that conduct, the agreement, the criminal partnership, occurs wherever individuals are present at the formation of the agreement. And it's undisputed in this case that there was a co-conspirator present in the United States, in Maryland, throughout the entire agreement, at formation and throughout the entire criminal conspiracy here. And that is why the conspiracy occurred under the plain language of the statute, occurred in part, just has to occur in part, in the United States. Now, for the same reason, you know, and for very similar reasons, step two of the extraterritoriality framework also establishes that the prosecution of Mr. Ojudokun was proper in this case. That inquiry looks, what is the object of the statute's solicitude? In other words, its focus, which can include the conduct it seeks to regulate, the parties and interests it seeks to protect or vindicate. And if that conduct relevant to the statute's focus occurred in the United States, then the case involves a permissible domestic application. And we've cited all these cases going back to Ford in the Supreme Court that have held that a criminal conspiracy, there's jurisdiction in the United States for a criminal conspiracy when there's an individual who's present in the United States, when it's formed, and when there's overt acts and furtherance of the conspiracy take place in the United States. That also is longstanding law that establishes that the solicitude of the object of the statute's solicitude, the criminal conspiracy, the partnership in crime, the collective criminal venture, occurred in the United States, and that is what is being prohibited here. That's the focus here, and it occurred sufficiently in part, in the United States so that this is a domestic application. So whether you look at it through the lens of the explicit express extraterritoriality provision in 1956F or under step two under the of the framework, this is a proper prosecution of the defendant here. And I'll briefly, and now for all those reasons, this court can simply assume that the review is de novo and affirm for these reasons. But it's our view that Mr. Oshodokun needs to satisfy the plain error standard. He failed to preserve this claim. And Mr. Oshodokun has raised a few reasons why he thinks...
Well, jurisdiction can be raised at any time, can it?
Subject matter jurisdiction can, Your Honor. And the Supreme Court in Morrison made clear...
So why are you trying to argue...
Your Honor, in Morrison and in all the cases following Morrison have made clear. So in Morrison, the lower court said that
if we don't have any jurisdiction, we don't have any jurisdiction.
Your Honor, this is not a matter of subject matter jurisdiction.
Maybe I may be simpler than some of you. I don't know how you get plain error out of. We can recognize that or oblige to even on our own with no, if none of the lawyers ever raised jurisdiction.
Your Honor, I would direct the court to Morrison and this court's application of Morrison and Harris. Both of them are cited in our brief. What happened in Morrison was the lower court, the Second Circuit, treated the extraterritorial reach of a statute as a matter of subject matter jurisdiction. And Justice Scalia's opinion in Morrison said no, that's just wrong. The subject matter jurisdiction goes to the power of the court to adjudicate, and the court had a power to adjudicate whether the scope of the statute, what the issue here, it's a merits question as to the reach of the statute. And
well,
every court...
He said it really wasn't jurisdiction.
Right? I'm sorry, Your Honor, I couldn't hear you.
Well, I'm sorry. It sounds like he said it's not really jurisdiction. It's on the merits.
Yes, exactly. That's what Morrison said. And that's what this court said in Harris, where it said, okay, because the extraterritorial reach of a statute goes to the merits, then it's subject to all forfeiture and waiver and procedural default rules. And so that's in Harris. And all the courts have applied that. So we cite cases where courts apply plain error.
If you look at it that way, you can do it, I guess.
Yes, Your Honor.
I got another question. That fellow, your colleague there on the other side, didn't argue his superseding indictment claim. That you're satisfied with your brief on that and Judge Grimm's ruling?
We are satisfied, but I'm happy to go into it. The issue
I'll just let you rest on your brief if you want to. I just want to make sure that you're satisfied you don't need to argue too.
Well, Your Honor, I'm happy to go through it. Maybe if the court has questions, we can discuss those. I mean, the issue is whether the superseding indictment relates back to the original indictment. And the standard there is what...
And Judge, you all said it did. Judge Grimm said it did. And they say it didn't. And they brief it extensively. But then he didn't argue. And I just didn't want you to get mousetrapped by it. Those, anyway, I thought it was interesting. And the other question, they claim an ineffective counsel. And this is a direct appeal, but they do have a claim of ineffective counsel against somebody. Do you know which lawyer they're talking about?
I believe it would be the trial counsel, Your Honor, for failing to...
I thought there were two of them. There was one lawyer, and then they got a... Maybe then the public defender came in.
I think the defendant was represented by, I believe, CJA counsel at trial. I don't know if earlier, I believe that earlier the federal defender may have been initially appointed. I don't know the answer to that, Your Honor, but I know at trial and at the time when the suppression motions were filed, the defendant was represented, I believe, by a CJA lawyer. And that's the moment when any kind of suppression claims had to be filed before trial at the deadline set by the district court. And in our view...
Right.
Yes.
Go ahead.
Oh, sorry, Your Honor. But a couple points. I mean, as to the ineffective assistance claim, this court has never permitted a remand for additional fact finding. It has identified three different ways that a defendant can raise an ineffective assistance claim. One is in a Rule 33 motion in the district court. That wasn't done here. It's not at issue. Number two is on appeal if it's conclusive from the record that there's an ineffective assistance claim, and that is just not the circumstances here. And then number three, on collateral review under 2255.
That is when, it's normally a thing for collateral review. I was trying to figure out who was supposed to be constitutionally ineffective, but you don't know either.
Well, it's the CJA lawyer. I don't know his name, but the CJA lawyer who represented Mr. Ojedokun in the district court at the time he filed his... No, he's not here now.
Well, there's a CJA lawyer on appeal, in the appeal. How many lawyers does this fellow have? Can you tell me that?
I believe at least three, but I don't know definitively, Your Honor.
Okay. All right. That helps because I do it just two. But... it wasn't clear to me. But we shouldn't be reaching any of that stuff. That's for
absolutely review. Yes, you should
This government's position. That's the normal position, and that's normally what we do.
Yes. And briefly, just the suppression claim is, in our view, is fully waived. It's not. There's nothing for this court to review. Because the Rule 12 requires that a defendant file a suppression motion and raise any suppression claims prior to trial, and a district court can, can consider a suppression claim subsequently only if the defendant establishes good cause. And
the district court fully considered this and ruled in your favor.
No, Your Honor, there was no consideration of the suppression claim in the district court. It was raised
for the
first
time. I thought he ruled that everything was all right in his memorandum opinion.
Yes, he did, Your Honor. And then on appeal, Mr. Ojedokun is raising an entirely new suppression claim that he did not raise in the district court. Yeah.
All right. Okay.
And that claim under Rule 12 is barred for any review, a plain error or otherwise, because there's been no attempt to show good cause, let alone a showing of good cause. We cited the cases that we do recognize that there's disagreement among the courts of appeals. Some courts will allow appellate review on plain error without showing good cause. But the majority view and the view what we believe is correct is that a defendant must show good cause either in the district court or the court of appeals, and that if the defendant does not show good cause, there's no appellate review of a suppression claim on appeal. This court has left it open. It has not gone one way or the other. I can say, like, most recently in the Fall case, which is 955 F 3rd 363 at 373, the court did make clear that it's an open issue in this court. We did cite cases that have applied the waiver rule, but there are also cases where the court has reviewed for plain error. We think that the reason that the court did that in those cases is because the government didn't assert waiver, and so we essentially waived waiver. But we're not waiving waiver here. We're asserting that the defendant has to show good cause, and therefore you cannot review the suppression issue. But even if you were under a plain error review, there's no error here, let alone plain error. There was consent to enter the home. It's not clear or obvious on this record that the consent was not knowing, and that the interview was within the scope of the consent. And even if you assume that there was no consent and that the intrusion into the home somehow violated the Fourth Amendment, this court's decision in Seidman precludes any finding of error, let alone clear or obvious error. That case is really resolves this case.
When they walked in, was he under arrest?
No, Your Honor. No.
Why not? They had a warrant that says to arrest him forthwith, did it not?
They wanted to approach him to see whether he would voluntarily.
I know what they wanted to do, but they had a warrant that said he's under arrest forthwith. And we all know what forthwith means. So when he answered the door, they had that paper duly authorized, right? by authorities, he was under arrest.
No, Your Honor, he was not under arrest until he was placed in custody. They had the authority, the constitutional authority, to place him under arrest. They did not exercise that constitutional authority.
Well, what I'm asking is, do you think at that point when he walked, could he leave?
Yes, that's what if he tried to leave, then he would have been arrested, but he couldn't leave.
So you're saying they have to put their hands on him for him to be under arrest?
They have to place him under arrest, Your Honor.
No, do they have to put their hands on him for to be under arrest?
No, Your Honor, that's not the law. But here, if you look,
so it's not the law, but they did have papers that instructed them that says forthwith execute this arrest warrant, correct?
I don't know, Your Honor. I don't recall, but I'm assuming that it does. Yes.
Yes.
Now that occurred in Maryland. Where was that? In Maryland.
That was in Illinois, Your Honor.
Illinois.
Yes.
State. He was then in the United States. He was in Illinois. All right.
Yes, he was in college. He was in a PhD program in Illinois, and
one judge. Right. They had the warrant in their pocket when they went to see him.
Correct. And this was all litigated as a Fifth Amendment Miranda issue in the district court. Was he in custody?
Right. But that's what it was.
That's not on appeal. That's not. There's no claim that there was error in that determination on appeal. The only claim is that the entry into the home violated the Fourth Amendment, and therefore the voluntary interview must be suppressed. But that's contradicted by Seidman, where a government cooperator entered into a home without consent and then engaged in a conversation that he recorded with the defendant. And this court said, we're going to assume that entering to the home was a violation of the Fourth Amendment, but that voluntary conversation was not the tainted fruits of that. And here, there's no way of finding clear or obvious error under Seidman. It doesn't follow from that. So again, so there's no question of whether he was in custody. It's accepted that he wasn't.
There may be an argument, but it's certainly, you're right, it wasn't raised here, wasn't raised there, it wasn't raised with the district court.
Yes, I mean, the issue in the district court was all about Miranda, Fifth Amendment, custody. That's not what's at issue here.
They went in the kitchen and sat down with him, didn't they?
What happened was they were outside.
They didn't search the house or anything. They just sat down and talked to him.
No, and the district court went all into this when he said when he talked about how they didn't even conduct a security sweep or anything. What happened is they, and this is on the transcript and the recording, the agents said, can we talk to you? And they indicated, you know, whether, you know, inside or outside, it was, they were indifferent to that. And he said, oh, either way. And they said, oh, can we go inside? He said, yeah, sure. So they went inside. Really, it was for the convenience of the defendant there. It wasn't for any investigative purpose because they didn't search the whole house. There was no Fourth Amendment intrusion inside the house. There was no search or anything. The agents would have been perfectly happy.
Let me ask this question. If they had told him that what the truth was, told him the situation, that they had an arrest warrant for him, could they have talked to him and asked him those 140-some questions without reading his rights?
Well, I think that at that point, there would have been a totally different calculus as to whether he was in custody, Your Honor, and under Miranda. Yeah, under Miranda. So under Miranda.
No, they had told him that we have a warrant for your arrest.
Yeah.
Didn't take hold of him and the things that, and said, I want to talk to you. They would have to read rights, right? Rights would have to read.
I believe that's correct, Your Honor, because it's an objectively reasonable standard known to the defendant. So at that point, he knows he's under arrest, and so he can't leave. So so then you get into the custodial interrogation parameters of Miranda. Yes, if you're in custody, you have to be read your rights, and you have to waive them. But he was not. The district court here found he was not in custody. That's not a challenged on appeal. Instead of trying to evaluate this through a Fifth Amendment Miranda lens, the defendant has decided to take an entirely new Fourth Amendment tack, which asks, which is saying that, oh, well, going into the house, even though it was incredibly voluntary.
I agree that the attack on the Fourth Amendment, you're absolutely right. It's a different question. All right. That's fine.
Mr. Pelletieri, did you try this case?
I did not, Your Honor. This is a criminal, I'm in the criminal appellate section in Washington, D.C., and we're handling the appeal for the U.S. Attorney's Office in Maryland. This case was tried by the U.S. Attorney himself.
I just wondered, you're the appeals expert. It's obvious you've done a real good study of it.
Thank you, Your Honor. And if there aren't any additional questions, we would ask that the court affirm.
Thank you, Mr. Pelletieri.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Mr. Newton?
Yes, Your Honor. I want to keep coming back to something that's critically important concerning the first issue. Everything has to be analyzed looking at the language of Section 1956 F1 and F2. The language of F1 says the charge conduct, by a United States is by a United States citizen, or in the case of a non-United States citizen, the conduct occurs in part in the United States. That's not particularly clear language. Clearly, if you're talking about a United States citizen who does something abroad, it's just that citizen's conduct by a United States citizen, not what a co-conspirator does. The next clause, or in the case of a non-United States citizen, the conduct occurs in part in the United States. That's at least ambiguous about whether it's just the defendant's conduct who's the non-citizen. At the very least, that raises a doubt, in addition to all the other things I've pointed out. This is not a normal conspiracy for two reasons. One, it's a money laundering conspiracy that doesn't require any act, any conduct. Two, it has to be analyzed through the lens.
You've ever been involved in a drug conspiracy?
Yes, Your Honor. I've handled many of those cases.
I suspect that you have. And, you know, that 846 doesn't have any requirement of an overt act either.
That's correct. Nor does RICO.
That's right. So there's a number of conspiracies that don't require overt act.
That's correct. But they would be analyzed the same way.
There's a lot of law on that stuff in the law books, you know.
That's correct.
You refer to this as the first issue. Do you refer to the first issue as a jurisdictional issue?
It is a subject matter jurisdictional issue. The government cites Ford and other cases and talks about venue. What the government doesn't cite in their brief, which I cite in the reply brief, is Arbaugh. The Supreme Court said in Arbaugh in 2006, in determining whether something is jurisdictional or merits, you look at the language of the statute. This statute explicitly uses the word jurisdiction. This is unquestionably a subject matter jurisdiction statute, just like 1332 would be in a diversity case. The Title VII statute they interpreted in Arbaugh, they didn't use the word jurisdiction about the number of employees. Here they use the word jurisdiction about the conduct of the non-United States citizen, and the case has to involve a transaction. Again, you've got to analyze it through the language of 1956 F1 and F2. The government hasn't even talked about the fact that F2 says there has to be a transaction. There's no transaction that's an element of money laundering conspiracy. Why? Why is this an issue? Because they wrote the statute in 1986 before conspiracy was even part of Section 1956. There were only substantive offenses in 1986 that required transactions. Look at the legislative history. I cite it in footnote 15 of my reply brief. Congress clearly was envisioning.
There were plenty of conspiracy charges that could be brought. As you know, the 371, you can bring 371 conspiracies if you want.
That requires an overt act. If that would have been
that's right. An overt act is pretty simple. That could be a phone call or across the street, or it could be most anything.
But
an
it's
overt
not
act hard. Doesn't have a criminal act, my friend.
An overt act.
I don't know who the lawyers that you're claiming were ineffective.
There were two lawyers. One was a CJA attorney who initially handled the case and filed one motion to suppress. The second was a retained lawyer who filed other motions to suppress and also tried the case. So there were two lawyers who filed.
You're saying both of them were ineffective
by not raising the only viable constitutional suppression issue there is in this case, which is when the FBI agents approached him, they said, We would like to ask you a couple of questions, a few questions. It will only take a moment. It will be really quick. Those are all their words. And can we come in and ask you these questions? In Randolph, the Supreme Court said you look at societal expectations in determining Fourth Amendment issues. If somebody comes to your door and says, oh, can I borrow your phone real quick? I need to make a phone call. My tire's flat. And they stayed in your house for 68 minutes and talked for 144 questions about your personal life. That would go way beyond the expectation that society understands you're giving them when they come in. That's exactly what happened. They lied to him. They weren't planning on it in a couple of questions.
To see who you were, which ones you were claiming were ineffective, and that all tied to that one issue.
It's all tied to that one issue. I'm only saying all the suppression that were filed, this was the one that should have been filed. If I could go back to the government's arguments about venue very quickly. Venue is not jurisdiction. That's well established. Venue is not jurisdiction. So anything they cite about venue being proper where a co-defendant does an overt act says nothing about 1956 and F1 and jurisdiction.
Before you go, Mr. Lee, would you respond to Mr. Pelletier's argument that actus reus alone becomes the conduct even though overt act is not required for conspiracy for money laundering?
So in my brief, I discussed the dictionary definition, the legislative history definition of what conduct means in 1956 F1. Although in some abstract sense, looking at general conspiracy law, sure, maybe the forming the conspiratorial agreement could be viewed as an actus reus in a case that doesn't require an overt act. But the problem is, again, we got to go filter everything through 1956 and its text and its legislative history. Congress unquestionably envisioned action, transaction, involvement, not just a mere conspiratorial agreement. And I will repeat and close with this. The statute was written in 1986. There was no money laundering conspiracy. There was no offense that could be committed without an overt act. There had to be some action by a defendant back then for there to be extraterritorial jurisdiction. They did not amend 1956 F1 or 2 when they added the conspiracy clause in 1992, and when Whitfield in 2005 said you don't have to have an act or a conduct, just the agreement itself. Bottom line is this is a square peg trying to be fit into a round hole. It doesn't work. Congress should have amended it. They didn't. There's at least a lingering doubt, and an appellant should get the benefit of that doubt. This court should remand with instructions to dismiss the indictment for lack of subject matter jurisdiction.
Well, thank you. Thank you both for your arguments. Mr. Newton, I note that you're court appointed, and on behalf of the Fourth Circuit, I want to thank you so much for that. We really rely on lawyers like yourself to take on these cases and help us in that regard. We appreciate it.
Thank you,
Mr. Pelletier, and thank you for your able representation in the United States.
Thank you, Your Honor.
We can't come down and greet you, but know very well that we really appreciate it. And thank you very much, and we wish you well, and be safe. Take care.
Thank you.
And with that, I'll ask the deputy clerk to adjourn this session of the court.
This honorable court stands adjourned until this afternoon. God save the United States and this honorable court.